gives me the greatest pleasure today to introduce Bertram Turetsky. He is the internationally renowned and loved as the person who single-handedly created a whole new tradition for his instrument, the contrabass, moving it from the back of the orchestra right up to center stage as a solo instrument. He's one of the very few performers in all of music history to have had hundreds of new works written for him. He has performed and recorded these works, and music of every other era, too, in thousands of concerts around the world, influencing generations of musicians. Today, though, we're in a classroom, not the concert hall, and you're about to meet Professor Turetsky. His teaching has inspired many of the finest students ever to graduate from the UCSD Department of Music, not just the contrabass students, but all kinds of musicians, performers, composers, students of music theory, music history, and ideas. Students from every corner of the campus have also had their ears and their minds opened in his lecture classes on jazz history, on chamber music, on the history of American music, on the music of the big bands, you name it. But he didn't stop here on campus. Professor Turetsky has reached out to the people of San Diego again and again, bringing the joy of music into school classrooms across San Diego County and into all sorts of other places too, hospitals and libraries, and he's done it at every possible opportunity, like today at UCSD's open house. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Music, Professor Bertram Turetsky.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the lovely introduction, Cheryl Brown. It's very nice to be here with you this morning. There'll be time for questions, don't worry, and you may have them. Understand that there's no such thing as a silly question, because some of the sounds you may hear this morning may be different from sounds that you're used to. And I'd be disappointed if they weren't, some of them. Right. So, to begin with, let me introduce you to my instrument, my noble but misunderstood instrument. This is a contrabass. It is the least standardized bowed string instrument in Western culture. This is what we call a three-quarter size, or the regular. There are all kinds of small basses for little people, young ones, and there are larger ones for people who are basketball player style humanoids, you know, 7 foot tall, lots of big instruments. They're 7/8 size, and I don't know anybody who can play a full size. This size, it works fine for me. Our bows are held like this for the most part, and some people do hold the violin sort of bow, which they call the French bow, and they call this the German bow. Other people call it the Bohemian bow. I don't care what you call it, it's the bow of my preference. Now, if you look at the instrument, you'll see it has sort of sloped shoulders, whereas the violin has more straight shoulders. It has a round back, and it has just the same kind of corners as a violin. So this is almost completely a violin-shaped instrument. There is yet another family of instruments that was popular before the violin family took over, and these were called viols. They were a quieter instrument with a flat back, a sloped shoulder, and a very plain waist. And the bows were held similar to the way I hold my bow. So, now, the bass is called, I call it a contrabass, because in America, the large bassoon is called the contrabassoon. And then, in America, many people call this a double bass. So for me, this is linguistic inconsistency, not to be too academic about it. In England, they call the large bassoon the double bassoon, and hence they say double bass. I think that's absolutely proper and appropriate. So I call it a contrabass, and that's what it is. 20 million Frenchmen call it a contrabass with a final E. 20 million Germans call it a contrabass. How can all those people be wrong? It's an instrument I fell in love with as a little boy. The first music I heard outside of the Orthodox synagogue was jazz music, and I fell in love with that sound. And then I figured out, ladies and gentlemen, that the bass player was the glue in the jazz ensemble. And I thought that was a nice thing to do. So I was drawn to the bass not by ego and not by applause, but by playing on a team, being with other people, fitting in, helping the music to flow, to move forward with some life. And I still play that music and I still adore it. I don't play it in smoky places late at night anymore, but now at festivals up and down this coast. So what do? When you do that, you play with your fingers, and this, of course, is what we call pizzicato. And you hear so much music where you hear this very nice rhythm that helps people dance, and so on. So we do that, and that became part of a tradition, and it's moved to a point where I have written jazz pieces. In fact, I'll probably play one. And the idea is to bring this music to the concert hall where young people can play who can't go in places where they have alcohol, and for all people who want to stay away from cigarette smoke. It's dangerous, no matter what big tobacco says. It's not good for us. So I try to do that. And I started with that music, ladies and gentlemen, and as I got a little older, I got to play quite well, and I came about drugs, and drugs were terrifying to me because I'm mostly a first-generation American. I'll explain that later. And we had quite a religious family, and the idea of being involved with drugs was just absolutely not possible. So the jazz world was loaded with it, and my reaction was sort of like Allen Ginsberg in his famous poem, Howl. I saw a lot of people get wasted, as one would say in the vernacular, and I thought this was not a good idea for me. So I got interested in classical music without, ladies and gentlemen, without the idea of being in a symphony orchestra as a career. I did play for many years in symphony orchestras, but I never wanted it as a career. The reason is very simple. Let me see if I can sing this morning. Now, you all know that song, and why should I work so hard, buy beautiful instruments, practice every day, buy beautiful bows to do? I mean, what is that all about? That's pretty boring. So I felt badly because all the other instruments were playing melodies, they were playing tunes, and I was carrying them. I was, in fact, carrying a whole symphony orchestra, me and my colleagues with the bass. So I thought that wasn't so good. And then came along a few composers, and they said, well, we'll give the old bass player something to do. And Camille Saint-Saëns, in his Carnival of the Animals, had each animal depicted by a musical instrument. And so the bass, do you know what animal the bass played the part of? Yes, you get an A. And it sounds like this. The piano goes boom, chick, chick, again, and then two more times, and the bass player gets nervous. And all the little children laugh. How does that make you feel? What's the answer? Terrible. And if you don't play it funny, you know, slide, the conductor looks at you and says, what are you doing? You're blowing it. You gotta make the kids laugh. How about my soul? How about my spirit? They're laughing at me. Are they laughing at me? Yeah. Well, one day I got the conductor mad. I decided that I was going to play the elephant who just came off a Jenny Craig diet, you know? She had a very swelt elephant with a beautiful tutu that smelled delicious. And it wasn't going to slide down, and she had control of her trunk. So something like... And then she sang a little bit. And he was looking over at me, "What are you doing?" And I smiled back at him. "I'm just having fun." I wasn't asked to play the elephant for a while in that orchestra after that, and I was grateful. So the bass had that kind of karma for me, and I played in orchestras for a long time, and I enjoyed it often, especially coming into the arena and playing with great, great artists like Emil Stein and Isaac Stern and Leonard Rose, many times with Leonard Rose, and Julius Baker, the great flutist. And just being in the orchestra with these great people, Claudio Arrau, William Marcellus, brilliant but relatively unknown American pianist. It was wonderful fun. And but still, I wanted more from the instrument. And I try to figure out a way out. Creativity. My father, who was American-born, who spoke five languages, including Latin and Hebrew, my father always told me that I could be anything I wanted to be, provided I was tenacious and worked hard. You can be anything you want. And I used to tease him, "You mean the president? I could be the president too, Dad?" "You can be anything you want. Just got to work hard." Well, ladies and gentlemen, I believe that, and I believe it now. And now I live in Del Mar, California. A friend of mine from Kentucky saw Del Mar and he almost fainted. He said, "It's so beautiful." He never saw the Pacific Ocean. He said, "It's so wonderful." He said, "You're so lucky." I said, "I've worked very hard for this. Nothing to do with luck. It has to do with creativity, tenacity, and hard work." He said, "Okay, I agree." So that's that. Ladies and gentlemen, a friend of mine from school took his life, and he was a composer, and I found out that he took his life because no one wanted to play his music. He was 26 years old. And suicide is nothing, has no appeal for me, something I don't understand at all. It's giving up, and I was not wired to even consider that. So, ladies and gentlemen, I called on his family. His sister had English, and she gave me some music that included my noble but misunderstood instrument, and we played it in a big concert in Hartford, Connecticut. His family came, and they said, "We had no idea our son was such a poet in music. He was so, oh, it was wonderful." And I thought, I have made some people happy. And had I moved quicker and had Nicholas been a more communicative, I could have helped save a life. And I thought, composers need performances. This instrument needs music written for it. Maybe we're made for each other. Maybe this could be a marriage. And I thought, what a good idea. Same time, one evening at a symphony rehearsal, a gentleman walked over to me in a tuxedo, which you don't wear at rehearsals, of course. And he said, "Can you play in 7/8 or 9/8, 5/8, all these different metrical configurations?" And I said, "Yes, I can." I said, "Why do you ask?" He said, "Because I play in a Greek band, and we play all these different rhythms and meters." He said, "Do you know anything about Greek music?" I said, "No, but I know about the food, and I like it." And he said, "Well, would you consider playing with us?" And my question was, "Do you pay a lot of money?" And he said, "Why do you ask?" I said, "Because my favorite wife told me that she is pregnant, and I need to make more money." "Oh," he said, "yes, we pay double scale, which is twice as much as the rest of the earthlings made in those days. So I spent some time with them, and one of the instruments that the Greeks have is a member of the guitar family called the bouzouki. And this leader used to bring bouzouki players from New York, and he got them before they were Coca-Colarized. That means before they started to play jazz licks and things like that, while they were authentic. And the bouzouki sounds something like this. So I heard it and I said, gee, that's wonderful. I love it. And I said, I went home and I said, I can do that. Remember? My dad told me I could do it. So I did it. I said, gee, that's lovely. It's a different kind of pizzicato. And one night I was playing a show in a Greek theater, and the trio Bel Canto, that's two bouzoukis and guitar, very famous trio, recorded, played all over the world. One of them leaned over the stage and started talking to me in Greek. So I figured I had made it finally. They accepted me, I was passing. And I said, no, I'm sorry, I don't understand the word you said, but I sure love the way you guys play. And then at intermission he came down and shook hands and they couldn't believe it. So I said, well, that's good, I've learned something. And in the 60s, you see, I'm older than most of you, and in the 60s, we had, everybody was interested in Indian music and sandalwood, incense and patchouli oil and bongos and espresso and all that, you know that. And so I was in Connecticut. Near Connecticut was Wesleyan University, which was one of the homes of world music study in this country. Mantle Hood at UCLA sort of started it, and then one of his disciples took it over. And Indian music was very big. They had some wonderful Indian musicians there. And one day I was invited over to do a lecture, and Professor Brown was going to do a lecture at the University of Hartford for me. And he took me to meet and hear some of these wonderful Indian musicians. And I listened carefully. And as someone who believes that you do not get an education only from an institution like this, but you get an education everywhere you go, keep your ears open, your eyes open, always listen, learn to listen. I've told my students always, be a good listener. It makes you a better person, too. Didn't work with my kids for a while, but after a while they understood that you have to get the message. So in Indian music, there's a drone. There's a sound that goes on and on and on. And there's your drone. And then with the sitar, of course, Ravi Shankar lives in North County when he's around. And we have a terrific sitarist, one of his real prize students. I'll stop before you levitate, right? Very good. So, ladies and gentlemen, I said, oh, that's interesting. You can't do that. I mean, who said you could do that on the bass? Nobody ever tried it. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try it. And at that time, something happened in the bass world. People said, oh, that guy Turetsky, yeah, he's crazy. Which leads me to, do not worry about rejection. You want to be an artist, you deal with it all the time. A painter, a composer, a singer. Don't listen to rejection. You know that, well, certainly music criticism is just, you know, it doesn't hardly exist. There are very few real music critics. There are a lot of people who are sort of journalists, and they write interesting columns. And then the other people are failed artists, so they just write very negative crits, if you want to call them that. Their job, for my money, is to say how good we are and help us have a career. That's my take on music criticism. Anyway, you can take that for what it's worth. So suddenly I found that I'm building up a repertoire of things. One morning I was out with a string quartet, and the cellist, the cello. You all know what the cello is. The cello is a small bass, ladies and gentlemen. Now, let's make sure that you're not just hearing the words of a bass activist, of a rather aggressive bass activist. who just loves to speak to people about this instrument. Cello in Italian means small, and violone is a generic term for a bowed string instrument, so small bass. Remember that. And when you see your favorite cellist friend or neighbor and you're having coffee, just remind them that they're playing a small bass. And then when I'm on a roll, I talk about the viola and the violin as being smaller basses, and so on and so forth. And then people start to either giggle or get angry. And it makes no difference. I'm not going to change my tune. So I started to see that this instrument has lots of possibilities. And this cellist was supposed to give me 10 minutes. And she was carrying on and carrying on and carrying on. I'm sitting there backstage and I'm thinking, well, So finally she said, and now Mr. Turetsky will play the bull fiddle. And that was an insult. So I went to war. I said, ladies and gentlemen, I should like to do some things that you can't do on the little bass over there. And which is a little arrogant, but sometimes you need that. And so she sat down and she smirked. I still remember it was maybe 40 years ago. I have a long memory. I don't forgive. I'm not Christian. I can't turn my cheek. So I said, what the hell am I going to do now that I opened my mouth? Ah, I got an idea. I said, ladies and gentlemen, have you ever seen a hand drummer? They're very happy. There's no intermediary. There's no sticks or anything. And they play beautiful. In Indian culture, you're a drummer because your father was a drummer and his father was a drummer. There's no question about what are you going to do in your life when you're born. So I did. Children started making all kinds of noise. They were going crazy. And I smiled at the cellist. And I said, well, that's just a little bit of what we can do on this noble but misunderstood instrument. And I have no more time. And thank you very much for your kind attention. And the principal came up and shook my hand and not the people with the small basses. And it was a great triumph. So the moral of that story is, if they give you lemons, make lemonade. We don't give up. That's how you do it, folks. You don't give up. So I wanted some music to play in concerts and get out of the orchestra. And I thought, well, if they don't write it for me, I better write it myself. Also, somehow, anytime I held my wife's hand, she became pregnant. And I did that three times during our 42 years of marriage. And we have three children. So I couldn't afford commissions for composers. I just didn't have that. But so I used to go to composers and play for them and show them things I could do that you couldn't do on other instruments and try to interest them. And I didn't have the money for a commission. So I figured I had better be creative and tenacious. Many of them said, well, Bert, we like you very much, but the bass isn't a solo instrument. Tenacious, tenacious. I said, oh, well, I'm sorry you feel that way. So often years later, they'd come to a concert and they said, we were wrong 5 years ago. We were wrong 10 years ago. We were wrong 20 years ago. I've been around a long time. And I'm planning to be around for longer. So the idea is that you hang in there and people say, yeah. I remember a lot of people who had 15 minutes of fame. You all know what this is? I steal them from restaurants. They're chopsticks. And if you ever see me in a restaurant, you know that I'm taking them home. And because I use them. In Aptos, California, is a man who's about 85 years old. His name is Lou Harrison, born in Oregon, and studied with Henry Cowell and Schoenberg, a wonderful composer. And he likes the idea of pan canto, all sound music, instead of bel canto, which was more European-oriented. And Lou is a friend of mine, but long before I met Lou, I was looking toward the East instead of looking toward Europe. I'm not Eurocentric at all, as most American musicians are, even though my name is Turetsky, which is very Slavic. My mother's passport says Poland, but she speaks Russian and Ukrainian, or she spoke Russian and Ukrainian as well, and German. It was the land that everybody was taking over when they went to war. So this is a little excerpt from a piece called Lou Harrison, and I used this to find another sound for the noble instrument. Then I pick up the bow very elegantly in tempo, but I'm not ready to do that this morning. And then I play something. Probably noticed that it's a singing sound. Some of the great violin players of the last century and of this century are all come from the same part of the world as I do. I don't pound on my chest. I just thank God every day that I have that in my DNA and in my wiring. Isaac Stern, who just died, a Russian Jew from San Francisco, Pinky Zuckerman, Yitzhak Perlman, Yasha Heifetz, the beat goes on, and all these people have that kind of background. And the idea of being able to sing on an instrument got all these people out of the ghetto. I was never in a ghetto. We were fairly comfortable, but economically challenged often. And the way to do it was to be very good at what you choose to do. And since I love what I do, I worked hard, and I'm getting there. Things are happening. So I found yet another sound. Oh, yes, I'd like to play my encore now before the performance is over, which is a little different than most people. In 1973, I found myself in Warsaw, and it was interesting getting off the airplane and seeing soldiers with guns. I had not seen that before. Now I was in the airport on the weekend, and I saw it, and it wasn't amusing. And we got in, and I told my wife, I said, don't a lot of those ladies look like mom, like my mother? And they're body types and facial types, and I felt very at home. And they looked at me, I guess I looked like a son of the soil, and they always have treated me beautifully. So the first concert, I played a piece by my colleague, the late Professor Robert Erickson, one of the founders of this wonderful department that I've worked in for 32 years. And everything was received just very warmly. And a piece by Kenneth Gaburo, the late Kenneth Gaburo, who came in the second wave with me in the music department, another wonderful composer. And after my part of the concert was over, I walked off and I heard, I never heard that before. In America, we applaud. It's always different rhythms, and you hear all the rhythms going together. So I went out and took a bow, and I said to my host, I said, what is that? He said, it's rhythmic applause, dummy. No, he didn't say that. He said, they really like you very much. You better play an encore. I said, oh, my God, an encore. What am I going to play? And my mind went blank. I didn't know what to play. So I took another bow, walked out, took a bow, took my bass out, and they kept on going. So I said, oh my goodness. Took my jacket off, my blue shirt was soaking wet, and I took a bow, and they kept on doing that. So he said, get out there. So I said, okay. And I walked to the end of the stage and sat down like I'm sitting, and knowing that everybody didn't understand English, I said, ladies and gentlemen, I should like to play an old English folk song. Everybody looked at each other and said, oh boy. And I played. Mm-hmm. And I faded away, and they made a lot of noise again. They really liked it. Whether it was the idea they liked my playing and the music, or the audacity of this middle-aged American to play a Beatle tune at a big festival of contemporary music, I never found out. But after that, every time I came back, there was an encore, and they all wanted the same encore. And some of my Mexican friends were there in Warsaw, and every time I would come to Mexico City, they would yell. I mean, we're friends already, so they'd say, "The Beatle tune!" And I'd say, "Oh, do I have to?" And I'd play Duke Ellington, you know, I'd play... No, the Beatle tune! They just wanted the Beatle tune. So, what we had figured out now is starting to build by using your thumb to play pizzicato. You get that soft sound without much attack. As compared to... You can hear the attack there. And so Polish radio and a lot of the European radios said, "Professor," they like to call you professor. Professor means you can sit in the front of the bus. And I like that. I like it quite a bit. And so they'd call, like Nancy and I, Nancy's my wife, Nancy and I would be having dinner and somebody would come in with half a pound of papers and say, "Maestro, yes, tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock, television." Okay, and then they'd give me złoty, the Polish currency, you know, almost like lira, almost valueless, you know, thousands and thousands of them, it's amazing. And so I'd go in and sort of, and I'd improvise something. And then I said, "This is getting dangerous. I better write some things down." So a lot of my pieces start on envelopes. In the back of an envelope, I write down a little idea. And as I kept on going back to Europe to do these things, I started to write some of them. And then I thought, well, gee, I think I've got a little collection of pieces. Let's see what I called it. Let's see what it's... Ah! Poems, Portraits, Ballads, and Blues. And I always loved Segovia's music making, even though he played a small bass called the guitar. He took the guitar out of the cafe and brought it to the concert hall. He was a great artist, a great man, and a very engaging performer. So this is a little bit of a piece called Segovia, in which I'm trying to evoke the spirit of the great master. So that's a bit of Segovia. And that's the guitar pizzicato. This is pizzicato tremolo. That's sort of the bouzouki sound. There's percussion sounds. With the bow, you can... The bow is like a paintbrush, ladies and gentlemen. Sort of a large one. And this area from the bridge, which holds the strings up, to the end of the fingerboard, you can get different colors. Same note, but a little different, huh? Ah. Behave. And over here. Almost like fingernails on the blackboard, right? Very nice. Everybody's favorite Halloween noise, right? That's called sul ponticello, which sounds perhaps like a new Italian ice cream. I'll have a sul ponticello on a sugar cone. And this is sul tasto over here in the fingerboard, or sur la touche in French. You darken the sound, and this is the normal place to get the sound. So you want to use these colors creatively. You don't want to be monochromatically oriented. My son Gerald, who is a big executive, who likes to remind me that he makes more money than I do. Gerald is a sweetheart. And once he had heard all these composers come in and play all this stuff for me, and he said, "Dad, I got a cool sound for you." I think he was 10, maybe younger. And so he grabbed the wrong side of the bow, and he put it in between the strings, and he went, "Doesn't that sound like electronic music?" I said, "Yes, and you're not wasting any electricity either." I said, "That's pretty cool." I said, "That's cool, Jerry. Keep up the good work." So he became a suit. He makes money. Sells shoes or something. I don't know. Anyway, he's a good kid. So I've shown people all those things, and they say, "Oh, this is good. Well, you can do lots of things the cello can't do." And I say, "Right, you are." And one of the nice things, you all remember studying physics or getting a little touch of it. And you know, if you touch a string halfway in 3-2, you can get harmonics. And of course, harmonics on the bass are the best of all string instruments because the string is so long and because you have such a big resonating chamber. So one time I thought I should write a piece about my favorite wife. And I had been writing pieces about Segovia and Lou Harrison and Charles Mingus. And she said, "Well, how about me, big boy?" So I said, "I better deal with it or else." So this is a little bit of a piece called Nancy. She's a flutist. So somehow the idea came to me, or maybe it didn't come to me, but a music critic said, "Well, of course, he wrote this for his wife." And so all these nice melodies in flute register were good. And so what happened, ladies and gentlemen, to move forward, because we're going to have a few minutes for questions and things. People said, friends said, "How would you like to make a recording?" And I said, "Gee, I think that would be cool." There was no master plan. The whole idea was to work, was to work. Every time you play a concert, you play your best. You give 110%, as athletes, these millionaires say, gave 110%. And you'd come out and you'd be soaking wet and you had left it on the stage. You tried your best, you prepared hard. And people began to know that they were going to get a serious performance. So people said, "Gee, I'd like to write a piece for you." Somebody would hear the piece and say, "That's a pretty good piece, but I think I could do better. Hey, Bert, I'd like to write a piece for you," right? And after a while, you develop a constituency. And composers began to come to the Turetsky concerts because they knew that he would be open to seeing their music and trying to play it. So suddenly, a groundswell of pieces happened. There was pieces written for bass players before, but when the orchestra got so big, they needed that 16-foot stop, those low notes, to hold them up, as I said earlier. And they had 8 to 10 bass players. And the little bit of virtuosity in the 18th century sort of got lost. So each composer would write a piece. Some of them were very good. Some of them are still alive. Some of them are published. I would always try to record them. And quite a few discs were made, or vinyl, as my students call them. And they got good reviews. I suspect no one was audacious enough at that time to walk on the stage with the instrument and display. I remember walking on stage at the Living Theater in New York in the 60s, and a woman almost fainted. She says, "Where's the piano?" I said, "I don't need a piano, lady." And I played, and she came backstage and said, "I'm sorry to have been rude. you don't need a piano. I said, well, thank you very much. A piano accompaniment to string pieces has always been de rigueur. So anyway, things started to happen, and I got a call out for music from the American Music Center. 1959, I sent it out. A lot of pieces came in. My wife did all the typing and made sure that we had the lists and helped me with all this. Some of the pieces were very good, and a career started. 1964, I made a debut in New York, which is what you had to do. You had to run the gauntlet of the New York critics, and they could be very cruel. Going in, I was so excited about the idea that I never thought about the possibility of failing. And in packing, I forgot to pack very good black pants. I had $5 black chinos on, which were pretty funky, ladies and gentlemen, pretty awful. And I said, Nancy, where's my fancy pants? I don't know. I said, okay. So I put on my tails and my white, my tie, and I went out on the stage, and Nancy gave me a kiss over here. So I walked out with lipstick all over here, in the front of a packed hall in New York City with these $5 pants, and they said, what the hell's going on here? What is it with this guy? And I started with an up bow, the piece with an up bow, which you don't do. It's very dangerous, especially if you're nervous. You can really make a sound that, you know, only God knows. So I started, and I saw a friend of mine in the audience do this, sit back like, oh, you jerk, you fool. Oh, I'm not going to look. It's going to be awful. Well, I said, no, it's not. And I guided it into a crescendo, and I started to play. I said, it feels good. I'm fine. There's a full audience. And so there was. Anyways, we waited up all night for the reviews, and they were terrific. I was lucky. And however, all the philosophers say there's no such thing as luck. Creativity, tenacity, hard work. And so it worked from there. And after a while, I found a piece from Robert Erickson, the composer, one of the fathers of the music department, who said, we'd love to have you come out west, blah, 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 blah. In 1967, I think I came through, and I did a show and tell, and Professor Ogden, the dear Mr. Chips kind of professor, Will Ogden put his arm around me, and he said, Bert, I'll show you your office. I said, I haven't done a concert yet. He said, we know all about you. We have all kinds of tapes. And that's what happened. So making dreams come true, living in California with this wonderful ethnic diversity, which is so exciting, you can hear all kinds of music, at a high-powered university where you can I remember having New Year's morning brunch with a Nobel Prize winner, meet all kinds of wonderful scientists like Sir Jacob Bronowski, who was a music aficionado. You know, only in a great university can you do that. And then, of course, in the life, you meet all these great musicians and how wonderful that is. So I don't know if I dreamed at all, but they really are dreams, and they've come true. So I'm talking and talking, but at 10 of, we'll give up. So any questions, I'd be very happy to answer them. Yeah?
The difference between bel canto and pian canto?
Yeah, very good. Bel canto is... bel canto is the kind of singing that comes out of Italy that we hear in opera. And it's very stylized with the rolled R, all the support down here. And you can hear a little bit left in Pavarotti, not much. He's got some problems. And but all the Italian, the three tenors, all come from this great tradition. There's a school of singing. And many people who want to be opera singers sing here. For me, pan canto is all the sounds of the world, ranging from a Tibetan monk who sings those octaves and all that, those kind of noises, to bel canto, to the jazz singer who doesn't always support their voice but touches your heart in a special way, like Billie Holiday or maybe the late Sarah Vaughan or Ella Fitzgerald. And so with an instrument, there's all kinds of sounds, and I think while we're alive, we should use them. It just shouldn't be Euro-centric music making. Yeah, it's a good question. I'm glad to answer it for you. Yeah.
Just one more.
Go ahead.
You described holding the bow
Yes, German style. French, and you hold it from above like the violin and the cello and the viola. Easy. I think you get more leverage if you've ever painted, I mean, not a portrait or anything like a fence or something like that, like Tom Sawyer. You've been practicing the German bow. You know, so maybe you'll be bass players. Yes, sir.
How have your skills changed over your career? Things you can do now, which you couldn't do in the enterprise?
I have refined some of them now. There's not much nerves, and I can focus in. I have learned to concentrate on what I'm doing. With the afterquake with the Silmar thing in the 70s, I was on the stage, and it started to quake at Schoenberg Hall, and my accompanist looked at me, shall we get out of here? And I kept on playing, and I thought, I got it. And so I think the focus, the ability to do that, has really developed, and I can. And I think I have more control with the bow and the fingers. I have more confidence to communicate with the audience than I did as a young person. I keep out a what if. You know, what if I slip? What if I drop this? And what if I do that? I don't think about that. I think about, I hear the music and I do it. So I've put the mind out. It's like the night that Reggie Jackson hit the three home runs in the World Series against the Dodgers. He said, I cleared my mind of everything, and the baseball got as big as a grapefruit. And when it came, I hit it. And that's what you do. You look at the music, you hear it, and then you become it, and you live it. And then you're on your way. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You've been a wonderful audience, as usual. I look forward to seeing you in classes. I look forward to seeing you in concerts or in a restaurant. Or come over and say hello. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Thank you.